It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Ross Reynolds. Delighted to welcome back writer George Saunders. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me again, Ross.
He's in town to talk at Seattle Arts and Lectures this evening at Town Hall. It's sold out, but they've got some standby tickets if you want to show up. Last February, you might remember our conversation about his best-selling fourth short story collection called 10th of December. It was hailed in February as the best book you'll ever read. You'll read this year already then, and I concur with that. You can listen to that conversation at KUOW.org. Just look up Saunders, S-A-U-N-D-E-R-S. In 2006, George Saunders was awarded a MacArthur Genius Grant. So if you are so unfortunate as to not have read George Saunders, here's what the MacArthur Foundation described his work as: mordantly hilarious tales that retain at their core deep sympathy and compassion for the lives he depicts. They combine satire and surrealism with a naturalistic, colloquial use of language, with a keen eye for absurdity, a precise ear for vernacular language, and a distinctly deadpan narrative voice, end quote. George Saunders, how do you like that summary of your work?
I'll go with it. Yeah. I'll take any summary of my work.
If there was such a thing as a job description for someone who writes fiction and you teach fiction, what would that job description be, do you think?
Well, I think it's to not know what you're doing, actually. You know, to kind of go in every day and think, well, I'm going to try to make some sparks. I don't know how or, you know, why. And just leave all of your agenda at the door. And then you come in and you start messing around with the story. And the main job is to try to listen to what the story is telling you. You know, you might think the story is about A. Well, in actually doing it, the story says, I'm not about A. A is boring. I want to be about this other thing. So for me, the real exciting thing is when you kind of get that scent, like, oh, I see. This is not what I thought it was. It's bigger than I thought it was. So in a sense, your job is to be the master of not being the master of anything.
That's so interesting. Could you give an example of maybe you came in and looked at what you'd written the previous day and all of a sudden something popped out to tell you about what it is that you were writing that maybe sent you in a different direction?
Yeah, well, sometimes for me that's unfortunately it's a months-long process where I had one story that I got stuck every day at page 5 or something, you know, and I kind of liked what had come before, but I couldn't figure it, you know, I was just stuck in my original idea of the story. And then at one point I was in the shower actually and I thought to myself about a particular speech in the story, why is that speech so false? It just sounds like a liar wrote it, you know? And then I thought suddenly, you know, why am I being a liar in my own story? And I thought, oh, wait a minute, I'm not. It's the character. And in that instant, the whole story, you know, I finished it about 2 days after that because I realized the prose was kind of rickety and false. I was blaming it on myself, but actually it was a character in the story who had, you know, the character flaw that I'd been attributing to myself. You know, it's like that.
So when you saw that, did it make you, like, change the frame around that false speech to
no.
sort of
well,
reinforce
yeah,
that element of it?
Sort of. In the sense that before I thought this woman had been telling the truth, and from the nature of the prose, I thought, oh, she's not telling the truth exactly. And as soon as I realized that, the whole story, and actually everything before that could say just as it was. But I had just been kind of over-controlling the story. I thought I knew who she was. And in that speech, she was almost sending up a flare like, I'm lying to you, you know. So that's the never-ending adventure of art is that you don't get to be in control of it. It gets to be in control of you. And you can wrestle with it for a long time. But that moment when you say, yeah, actually, I have to yield to the story, that's always a really deep one.
Where is that coming from? Is the muse talking back to you?
That's a great question. And as I get deeper into this, that becomes the question. The muse is like a symbolic name for the thing itself. I think it's probably, you can also say the subconscious. But to me, the really cheering idea is that there's some part of us that's smarter than we are, you know, smarter than the day-to-day self. And by certain artistic means, you can access that smarter part. So, you know, I often find that one of my stories will go from being, it'll go in the direction of being funnier and gentler and more ambiguous and a little more generous-hearted as I work on it over the months. So the way I see that is I'm accessing some better part of myself through the process of art. That's a pretty cool thing, you know. That you're not really the day-to-day you walking around isn't the end of the story. There's some deeper basement there that you can get at.
I've read that you practice Buddhism. Is that true?
Yeah.
How does that work with your writing, or does it work with your writing?
It does. I think it works with everything. I mean, I'm very much a beginner, so I'm not sure. I mean, I was writing for many years before. But what's interesting is a lot of the things that I had, quote unquote, learned from writing turned out to have a corollary in spiritual practice. So, for example, this idea of arriving at a story, not sure what it is, that's a pretty good analog for what you might, you know, strive to do in any moment. You know, you think you know who you are, you think you know the situation, but in fact, to be 30% more open to that would be a beneficial thing. And also, I think just this idea of kind of abiding with the story and saying, you know, I really don't know what you are, but I'm willing to hear it. That seems to me to be kind of related to the, to that, you know, that practice.
Did you know that before you began to practice Buddhism?
Or? Yeah, I think I knew it viscerally. I mean, because that's what, for me, you know, I had a really long idiotic apprenticeship where I just was writing nonsense for a long time. And I had a breakthrough that was really all about that, about instead of you being in charge of your story and you, instead of you being sort of the, you know, the white male oppressor who's dictating your story and trying to teach a lesson or make a theme, you're actually like a, you're a receiver for that story, you know. And part of that process means you have to really be listening. You have to, like Stuart Dybeck, this great Chicago writer, says, a story is always talking to you, but you have to listen to it. So that was a big, I mean, it felt to me at the time as a kind of a spiritual breakthrough because the way I was, had learned then to approach art was a pretty good way to approach life too, which is instead of having to trying to dominate it, you could sort of just be a good listener and then respond out of that that spirit of good listening.
I'm speaking with George Saunders, a critically acclaimed short story writer, his most recent collection from last year, 10th of December. Your day job is teaching creative writing at Syracuse University, where I understand one of your students in the Master of Fine Arts program was writer Cheryl Strayed, the author of Wild, who we've spoken to a couple times, and I'm a huge fan of hers. But I'm wondering, in the process of encountering people like that and the other students you've had, talent develops at different speeds. Are you able to tell from the first writing you receive from a student kind of what kind of talent they have?
Well, yes and no. I mean, we just went through this process at Syracuse. We had this year 600 applications for six places.
Wow.
So we did a, you know, a marathon reading. And it was funny that there was four of our five of us. And at the end, everybody agreed on the top 10 or 15, you know. So that, so in that sense, the answer is, yeah, you can tell. Now, what happens after that, I think, is really mysterious. You know, they come, we get our six choices, they come. And then there's a whole other kind of attic where, you know, we find out if a person has a talent for developing her specific talent. And that's really tricky. You know, you just can't – that you can't predict. There are some people who we've let in who were so good on the application and then didn't thrive in that environment. They didn't. And other people who came a little bit from behind, you know, someone who maybe barely made it in, struggled the first 2 years, and then the third year really hit. So that's, I think, as a teacher, what we have to – what I try to not do is make pronouncements about who, quote unquote, has it and who doesn't. I think you really can't know. Mm-hmm. And I was a case in point because I wrote terribly the whole time I was in grad school. I couldn't do it, you know. So
would you have gotten into the Syracuse program if you'd applied?
Well, I did get in, but I got in 1986, and I wouldn't have gotten in 85 or 87 or 88.
Really?
yeah, for sure.
Why that year?
I just had a good year. You know, I'd the year before that, I'd been writing this really imitation Hemingway. Had a good year, and then once I got to Syracuse, I kind of reverted and wrote stuff that I don't think would have gotten me. So when we're doing that selection, we try to be a little bit humble about it, and all you can really do is find six people you'd love to work with, but there's so many more people than that who are talented enough to get in and thrive. You know, you just can't know.
What can you teach them about writing?
Well, the main thing we're trying to do is teach them how to do or kind of guide them to do the thing that only they can do. Now, they don't know what that is, and we don't know what that is, but they're already writing beautifully, you know, and distinctively. And then the three-year game is to try to push them up into that one, just one level higher where they're doing something that really exudes them, you know, their personality, their interest, their kind of loving hearts or whatever. That's for me, I do it with line edits. I mean, that's, you know, real close line editing combined with some kind of an intuitive sense of who they are as people. So sometimes you'll see a person will write up to a certain level and pull back. Well, you can diagnose that with line edits. You know, you can see where they're pulling back. And then by knowing them, you can kind of get a vague sense of why they might be doing it. You know, it's not exactly psychological work, but sometimes you can just say, you know, for example, you're pulling out here at the most emotional moment of the story. I think it's because, from what I know of you, you have a sense that writing should always be edgy. You know, you're afraid of sentiment. Is that possible? And you can kind of see in their face if they agree. Then you can just give them a little permission, like, you know, I think you could be 10% more emotional here, you know? And that sometimes is sufficient to get the light to go on.
Do you remember working with Cheryl Strayed?
Oh, sure. Yeah, she's unforgettable. And she was a person who, her application was so full of love, you know? She was so comfortable with the positive valences of life. And that that's a shocker. Usually in the application pool, there's a lot of kind of, you know, edge and cynicism and kind of hipness. But she just had a real comfort with the positive aspects of human life, and that was so refreshing, you know. So she was just at the top of the pile right away, and she just got better and better over the 3 years. We didn't show her anything, really. She showed
she
us
was there.
Things. Yeah.
I'm talking to George Saunders, the short story writer. He's going to be speaking in town tonight at Town Hall at 7:30. Sold out, but there may be some waiting room tickets if you want to come by Town Hall to
some
check that out.
Walkouts, probably.
Walkups, yeah. You gave this great commencement address at Syracuse University last May. That's where you teach. And one thought you shared with the graduates is that accomplishment is unreliable, you said. And have you found that to be the case with your own accomplishments, the critical acclaim, the MacArthur Genius Award, the tenured professor position?
Yeah, well, I mean, I found that stuff has been really fun and really sweet. And it was what I was looking for, and I got it. But then as you get older, you know, you start to see that stuff's all rickety. I mean, for one thing, you could have a really amazing, stellar life and then fade from view within 2 years. You know, there's no – and also you can feel that it doesn't – I mean, as fun as it is, it doesn't really satisfy. I mean, if you're – when I was younger, I thought if I just published a book, I wouldn't be neurotic.
That'd be it.
Yeah. Well, it turns out I was worse, you know. So I think, you know, one of the lessons of age is that it's fun to accomplish, and you should. And otherwise, you know, what are you going to do? It's a joyful thing. But then once you get that stuff in your hand, you get the flowers in your hand, they start withering, you know. So that's okay. So that was kind of the thing, was that you can certainly accomplish, you need to, but don't count on it fixing you, because it won't.
George Saunders, thank you so much for stopping by. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Short story writer George Saunders, you're listening to The Record on KUOW.